This is 1A. I'm John Donvan, host of Intelligence Squared US, in for Joshua Johnson today. After several failed attempts at healthcare reform, you would think Republicans would consider the matter to be DNR, do not resuscitate. But the debate over the Affordable Care Act has found yet another new life and could actually come to a vote quite soon. The father of the ACA, Barack Obama, defended the healthcare law this week. He also had some strong words for his successor after Trump's speech to the United Nations.
Multilateral institutions and efforts are important. And you don't have to cede all your sovereignty, or it doesn't make you less patriotic to believe that. You just have to have some sense and read. So that's point number one.
We'll also be keeping an eye on Puerto Rico, where communities are covered in darkness in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. And we'll be talking about the most controversial cameo at this year's Emmy Awards. What a week it's been. A lot of news. And joining me for the Friday News Roundup, first, Lisa Desjardins, a correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, great to be here.
Also with me are the co-authors of a new book. It's called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Norman Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and E.J. Dionne, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Welcome, guys.
Great to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. And we are going to talk about your book a little bit later on in the hour. But first, let's jump into this healthcare pass that the Republicans are making yet again. The New York Times referring to it now as zombie healthcare. Lisa Desjardins, tell us why this third round, this session, how it's come about, why it's come about, and why there's a deadline.
Well, I think the how you could spend a long time talking about, but it just comes down to the fact that Republicans promised to repeal Obamacare. They have a deadline now to do it by September 30th, or they lose the ability to do it with just 50 votes this fiscal year.
Because
of what's called budget reconciliation. Mm-hmm. It's sort of one kind of a weird off-ramp in Senate policy that allows you to pass, you know, usually just one time a year, some kind of fiscal legislation with 50 votes. And it's a bit complicated why, but it has to be during that set fiscal year, which ends on Saturday, September 30th. So they have until 11:59, the next Saturday, two Saturdays from now, to do this. So there's a lot of political pressure. And I think what we're seeing is all politics and not a lot of policy discussion. And in fact, I can tell you sources, I spent all day yesterday on the phone with very steeped Republican policy directors all in the Senate side. And what I heard from them was not a lot of discussion on the policy. And they could not necessarily answer a lot of my questions. For example, how can they guarantee that this will not take coverage from more people? To that question, one healthcare policy guy told me, I can't guarantee that the sun can come up. That's not a real policy answer.
EJ, then who does know what's in this bill?
Well, it's not even fully clear that the sponsors know what's in this bill, given
really?
That they're making all kinds of claims about it that aren't true in terms of how many people it'll cover, what it'll do to pre-existing conditions. And it's very clear, and there have been a lot of stories on this, that the Republicans are doing this in response to part of their political base. It sounds like they heard from some of their people back home, well, you guys failed on repealing Obamacare. The irony here is that you're starting to see polling that shows that a lot of Trump voters understand that they benefited from Obamacare. If you look, for example, at Eastern Kentucky, Kentucky did a very good job of implementing Obamacare. This is a real stronghold for Senator Rand Paul and a lot of Republicans. Obamacare helped a lot of people in those places. And so you've got a lot of Republican senators on the line. Shelley Moore Capito is another one in West Virginia, who, if they vote for this bill, are voting to take health care away from a lot of their constituents. And so it's really a narrow politics rooted in how do you worry about party primaries versus a broader politics that says, how does this affect everybody?
Is that to say, Norm Ornstein, that it's not a sincere effort?
It's not a sincere effort if you think about coming up with a piece of policy that itself is coherent and can work and that satisfies what they say it will do. And I would have to say, John, we've never seen anything like this. Not a single health provider group, from the insurers to the doctors to the nurses and on down, not a single organization like the American Lung Association or Heart Association supports this. They're all very strongly opposed. This morning, the 50 Medicaid directors, that's a bipartisan group, all signed a letter, never happened before, saying, do not do this. This is a bill that's supposed to repeal Obamacare, but it also now will let Alaska keep Obamacare so that they can get the vote of Lisa Murkowski. And now it appears over the weekend that they're going to try to rein in conservatives by passing a provision or including a provision that won't let other states do a single-payer system or keep Obamacare as we know it. So there's no coherence here. What we had was, I think, best encapsulated by a comment that Charles Grassley, the senator from Iowa, Republican senator from Iowa, made to Iowa reporters, which is there are 10 reasons why we shouldn't be doing this, but we promised we'd pass something. And I would there's one other thing to keep in mind, though. We have not heard yet from the Senate parliamentarian. Lisa noted that this is budget reconciliation. Mm-hmm. It has to be fiscally related. And a lot of the provisions in this bill, at least given past precedent, wouldn't pass muster. If the parliamentarian says, no, these portions don't work, then they're left with something that's even less coherent, and they might fail before we get to the end of September.
But none of you are saying this is much ado about nothing.
This is a huge deal.
None of you is saying that this might not pass, actually.
This is an incredibly significant bill. I don't think it has a chance to pass as it stands. I think that's why we'll see some changes this mm-hmm. weekend. It's very close, obviously. You know, that's not. It certainly is on the table. It's still possible. But I think as far as Norm's comment about is this a sincere effort or not, I do think some Republicans, especially Lindsey Graham, this is a sincere effort for him. Now, mm-hmm. what it is not is a long thought out bill. It's not something that the Senate has spent time really delving into understanding. So I think we need to just hit on what's actually in this. What this bill would do is it would take the three major ways that the federal government now helps people get health insurance, which is through premium subsidies, tax credits, also through subsidies for things like deductibles, cost-sharing deductibles, and then also through Medicaid expansion. It would take those three things, end them all, and use all that money and give it to states in one very large lump sum. Now, Republicans love that because they do want more power to the states. But one thing that's not being talked about here, I think, John, is that what that also is doing is it's taking power away from individuals who are getting those credits now, but now the states may not give it to them. They might use it for other things.
Amen to that point. And, you know, this notion that this expands choice. I have a choice to buy a fleet of Rolls Royces. I mean, if you don't put money here, you're not giving people choice. But on this sincere effort question, what the Republicans are sincere about is they want to cut by a lot the amount of money the federal government spends to help people get health care. They want to reduce the size of government. They also want to follow this with a tax cut. Their problem is they can't really say, we're willing to take all these risks because we with people and with states because we want to cut this money. So they are making statements that can't possibly be sincere about what the bill actually does. And that's the bind on sincerity.
We're seeing this, of course, as politics is a lot right now, crossing into popular culture and the conversation going on there. And there's a little bit of a feud over this this whole issue between Jimmy Kimmel, late night host, and one of the sponsors of this bill, Senator Bill Cassidy. It's been a little bit hard to ignore.
Most of the Congress people who vote on this bill probably won't even read it. And they want us to do the same thing. They want us to treat it like an iTunes service agreement. And this guy, Bill Cassidy, just lied right to my face. Do you believe that every American, regardless of income, should be able to get regular checkups, maternity care, et cetera, all of those things that people who have health care get and need?
Yep.
So yep is Washington for nope, I guess. And I never imagined I would get involved in something like this. This is not my area of expertise.
Well, in a way, it's very connected to Kimmel because his son was born with a congenital heart disease this past year. And Kimmel started talking about that and using that experience to underscore his belief that there should not be lifetime caps to insurance, which is now one of the things that might go away. And then it went to a second layer. Senator Cassidy began going around talking about, I want to see if this passes the Kimmel test. And Jimmy Kimmel resented, I think, his name being brought into the promotion of the bill. But how much truth is there in Jimmy Kimmel's depiction of what would happen?
It's all true. And the point that he was making in the excerpt that we heard, Under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, there's a certain set of provisions of health care that includes preventive care, it includes maternity care, that have to be included in an insurance package. Cassidy's bill takes those away. So when Kimmel asked if everybody should have those, and Cassidy answered yes, Cassidy is, in fact, taking those things away. He is bringing back lifetime limits and annual limits that insurance companies will be able to provide, which means that if you're in a situation like Kimmel was with his son, who, by the way, is about to go through the third heart operation that he needs since he was born with a congenital heart ailment, the bills will already be well over $1 million, mm-hmm. which would, in many bills, many insurance plans, before Obamacare, would have meant that that child could not get insurance ever for the rest of his life. So a lot of the things that Kimmel has talked about are accurate. And Cassidy is left in a position where he's kind of floundering because he can't answer those questions.
We have 30 seconds.
A finer point on that. What this bill does is it gives states the ability to take back those essential mm-hmm. benefits and states the ability to waive those pre-existing requirements. So it's not automatic, but it could happen.
All right, well, just ahead, we're going to come back and discuss President Trump's America First message that he presented to the United Nations and talk about how it played on a global stage. This is the Friday News Roundup with Norm Ornstein and E.J. Dionne, co-authors of a new book called One Nation After Trump, and PBS NewsHour correspondent Lisa Desjardins. I'm John Donvan, host of Intelligence Squared U.S., in for Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm John Donvan in for Joshua Johnson, and it is the Friday News Roundup with Lisa Desjardins of the PBS NewsHour, Brookings Institution Senior Fellow E.J. Dionne, and Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. E.J. and Norm have a new book called One Nation After Trump, which we will talk about later in this hour. But let's get back to our review of the week's news now. And E.J., you wanted to say something else about the Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah, I've noticed this morning there are some conservatives attacking Jimmy Kimmel, saying an entertainer shouldn't enter the policy debate. And I just noticed that many of these conservatives are great fans of Ronald Reagan, who was an actor who had very strong views on a lot of policy questions long before he became president. The test of a citizen's intervention in a policy debate is what he or she is saying true. And I think in Kimmel's case, what he's saying is true.
Well, if you were the host of a reality show, are you an entertainer?
Well, apparently, yes. And it's okay for him to be president in the eyes of many of the people going after Jimmy Kimmel.
All right. Let's take a turn to something that's quite a bit more serious than the mood we're in right now. I want to talk about Hurricane Maria. It is still out there working its way across the Caribbean. It has killed 30 people so far across the islands. This morning, it crashed into Turks and Caicos. Dangerous winds, pounding rain. Now it's on its way to the Bahamas. Dominica and the Virgin Islands and others are just now picking up the pieces from their own encounters with this storm. In Puerto Rico, Maria knocked out power to the entire island, and officials are saying this U.S. territory may not have any electricity to speak of for months to come. We want to now connect with, from the Virgin Islands, Neville James. He is the Senate Majority Leader for the Virgin Islands Legislature. Senator James, thanks so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. How are you?
We're fine, and I'm sure in better shape than you are. You definitely have the support and empathy of everybody on this side of the water. Can you tell us an assessment now overall, a bird's eye view, how bad is it?
The devastation is real. This is pretty similar to what we went through with Hurricane Hugo back in 1989. I'd say two-thirds of the island took pretty much a direct hit. One-third of the island is not as bad as it could be, but we've been through this before, so it's really about overcoming the inconvenience, dealing with the fact that you're going to have power issues and not be able to function like you normally do for at least a month and a half, 2 months, but we'll overcome it.
I understand that the Virgin Islands, after prior bad experience with hurricanes, changed building codes over the last couple of decades, and that, in fact, things would have been worse had that not happened.
That is accurate. We went through Hurricane Hugo in 1989, and then we went through Hurricane Marilyn in 1995. St. Croix took a bigger hit in 89. St. Thomas and St. John took the bigger hit in 1995, and we changed the building codes subsequent to Maryland. So the impact is not what it was when we got impacted, when we got hit by the hurricanes back in 89 and 1995, respectively.
What are the island's immediate needs right now?
Immediate needs, I would say linemen to get our power distribution back in place because a lot of poles were snapped or broken. Mm-hmm. In addition, the general stuff, generators, whatever can be made available for consumption. Our problem is we were actually hit by a hurricane 12 days before in St. Thomas. Hurricane Irma devastated St. Thomas. So what had happened was St. Croix was playing a support role for St. Thomas and St. John. So this kind of compounded a bad situation and really made it worse.
And long term, what are the issues going to be?
Outside of the federal government, you know, providing that support that they normally do and are getting our government back in place. And we're a tourism-based economy, so we're going to take a bigger hit from that standpoint because we're not generating the revenue that we normally do. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to actually make do with much less than we normally do on a regular basis.
Do you have some read now on the kind of response you're getting from the federal government?
To this point, excellent response. They were very supportive in the interim between Irma and Maria, and they're here right now. They're on their way right now. We just cleared the airport. We're hoping to get planes to get back in. FEMA had to demobilize when they heard Maria was coming because they can't be here because we need them out of here so they can have the ability to get back in. So they demobilized over the weekend. Most of them left by Monday. We took the hit Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, and now we're in recovery mode.
And finally, I know communications are just a mess, but are you hearing any news from neighboring islands?
Communications is actually much better than we anticipated.
Oh, good.
Our cell phone carriers are up and running. Some are on roaming status. Neighboring islands, they throw their support. But a lot of us in the northern leewards, we got beat up. If you didn't get hit by Irma, you got hit by Maria. And, of course, you know Puerto Rico, which provides a lot of support for us. And they were going through a financial situation to begin with, and now they're totally devastated. So this is pretty much as bad as it can get as relates to us working together to get us back to where we need to go.
All right. Well, just so you know, you have the, as I said before, you have the support of everybody on this panel here today, and I'm sure all of our listeners, and we wish you the best fortunes going forward. Senator James, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So that was Senator James. He is the Senate Majority Leader for the Virgin Islands Legislature. All right.
John.
Go ahead, Norm, please.
Of course, we are with all these people who suffered a devastation. To bring it back to some of the policy dynamics we have, we had Harvey, which devastated Texas. We're talking about $150 to $200 billion in disaster relief, which will not be paid for. There won't be anything compensating. Irma hit Florida in a major way, North Carolina, South Carolina, as well as the islands. Now we had Jose with minor damage, Maria that's completely taken out Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, or American. We're probably talking $300 billion or more now that will be unpaid for. We will be coming within a matter of a week or two to another crunch point in terms of a budget and whether the government can stay open. And the conservatives, the Freedom Caucus in the House, which was opposed to any aid going out without offsets in the past, when it hit Texas, where many of their members are, they changed their minds. But now the bill is mounting, and we're going to have a budget crisis here that is really unprecedented as well.
Could I say it's good to hear from the senator that the federal government is coming through for the Virgin Islands, and obviously I agree with Norm's point. I just want to underscore that the people in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are part of us. They are American citizens, but don't have any votes.
Doesn't that say something that we have to say that? It seems strange that we would have to even say that.
Well, because they don't have votes in Congress, and they don't vote in our presidential elections like D.C. And I think it's a real test with our solidarity with fellow citizens. The federal government has to come through for the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, just as it should come through for Texas and Florida. And Puerto Rico has been flattened economically even before this storm came through. We need a real national discussion of how to lift up Puerto Rico.
Yeah, Norm's got it exactly right, that the U.S. the government, federal government, has been spending more, covering more of the disaster aid than it has in the past, starting with Katrina. And this is a massive bill, and this comes at a time to bundle us into other things that are happening right now, when Republicans in the Senate, this isn't getting a lot of attention, are opening up some very big checkbooks, and it's going to deficit spending. Things like $700 billion that the Senate passed for the military, mm-hmm. that's for the deficit, and maybe $1.5 trillion tax reform. Now we have hundreds of billions more, perhaps, in disaster relief.
I don't want to dig too deeply yeah. into the vein of cynicism, but Norm, I think you're suggesting that the Republicans in the Senate were willing to open the checkbooks, as Lisa puts it, because it was Texas that was hit.
In the Senate and the House, the number of people who voted against aid for Hurricane Sandy because it wasn't offset, and they wanted to offset it by cutting food stamps and some of these other programs, who then said, we don't need offsets for Texas. It was a hypocrisy that is greater than even we usually see in hypocritical politics. But now we're getting to an even larger point because, as Lisa said, we're really hemorrhaging federal dollars here, and the debt is going to grow dramatically. Mm-hmm. And how they handle this, and with the Freedom Caucus that doesn't even want the increases in defense, they want to cut back even more. This is going to be a headache for Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell past this health care debate in the couple of weeks that follow.
Can I shout out one Republican, Tom Cole of Oklahoma? Tom Cole, during the Sandy debate, said, I'm going to be back on this floor someday asking for help for Oklahoma because we get a lot of tornadoes. And sure enough, he was. And he told his Republican colleagues, we cannot vote against aid for other states in the Northeast and then come back and demand aid for our regions. We need a little more of that consistency in these debates.
Let's change courses here. The Russian influence investigation, a very, very big week, a lot stirring in there. We have Facebook now has agreed to turn over those 3,000 Russian-related ads to two congressional committees that have been asking for them. This comes 2 weeks after Facebook revealed that Russia had bought approximately $150 million worth of ads during the election. The president, President Trump, even today dismissed this as calling it, via tweet, the Russian hoax. He says the greatest influence over our election was the fake news media screaming for crooked Hillary Clinton. I guess we're not surprised by that, but how do the ads, this release of ads, EJ, change the story?
Well, I think this is potentially very important. First of all, I think Trump's sensitivity to this, the fact that he did choose to tweet and tried immediately to turn it into an attack on Hillary Clinton, I think shows that he's really worried about the direction of this investigation and the direction of this story. Secondly, there has been a lot of pressure on social media, and I think the argument is pretty airtight. We know quite a lot about ads placed on television. We know candidates have to have those little disclaimers at the end. I approved this message. Are we saying that if ads are put on social media by a foreign government, we have no right to know what's going on? And I think this is the beginning of a big conversation we're going to have about social media mm-hmm. and its responsibilities.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to 1A. Lisa?
You know, it's interesting. My colleague Dan Cooney at NewsHour has been having conversations with Democrats who have issued a letter, some of the House Democrats, saying they now want the FEC to regulate these ads on the internet. Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting step and something that I think especially younger Americans would want to pay a lot of attention to. Do you want the FEC regulating the internet in that kind of way? But it's opening up that discussion. Separately, as for the Russia discussion itself, we also saw, of course, a lot more come out about Paul Manafort.
Right.
You know, we are still waiting to get to, I think, the substance and crux of what they're learning. But his relationships with Russian oligarchs and report that he said he would brief one Russian oligarch during the campaign, all of that getting a lot of attention. This is a man who was in charge of the Trump campaign for just 3 months, but he certainly is one of the main characters in the investigation.
I think we ought to note that Facebook was not exactly forthcoming through much of this. Mm-hmm. They were delighted to take the $150 million, and now it's been dragged kicking and screaming out of them to get the information. But very important here is that this was an enormously sophisticated act on the part of the Russians. It wasn't just placing the ads. It's where the ads were placed. And they had to have backing and support and direction from very sophisticated American campaign operatives who knew where to put those ads. And the same with some of the release of information from WikiLeaks about congressional candidates. So as we go forward on this, we're going to come back to the issue of collusion. And there are going to be people whose names have not even been mentioned who I suspect will be coming forward.
Yesterday on 1A, the host of this show, Joshua Johnson, talked with John Maloney, who is a spokesperson for Paul Manafort. And here's a little bit of that conversation.
The search of his home, I mean, these are tactics that are reserved for violent offenders. People should be shocked. Whatever you think of Paul Manafort, whatever anyone's opinion is of him, if you were upset when Valerie Plame's identity was revealed, if you were upset when Chelsea Manning provided sensitive military documents to WikiLeaks, you should be equally disgusted at the treatment of Paul Manafort and the fact that he was surveilled by political opponents.
Or perhaps we would be equally disgusted that Paul Manafort might have helped the Russians to influence the American election. Does that make sense to you?
Paul Manafort did nothing to collude with the Russians to influence the election.
Let me correct myself. That's Jason Maloney. And you can hear that entire discussion at the 1A.org. But EJ Dionne, does Jason have a point?
No, not really. These are, the way I'd phrase it is, these are tactics reserved for organized crime figures. And I think that what Mueller is doing here is he's dealing with this as potentially a crime, if there is a crime, that's akin to organized crime. And, you know, he's looking into money. He's looking into financial relationships with the Russians. And then he's asking, did this lead to political acts? And we're going to find out. They had to go to court. They had to get warrants in order to make these searches. This isn't just some arbitrary thing that happened.
I mean, we should point out, we don't know Paul Manafort's side of the story to any degree. We know that they're sort of pushing back against the way the FBI handled things. I do also think that it's worth talking about a question mark that his side raises, which is all the leaks about this investigation, which are really noteworthy. I mean, this is a very serious investigation run by a very serious man, but yet many reports about wiretaps, about serious techniques have been getting out. And those are leaks that, you know, are not something the FBI usually wants, and usually in some, the Paul Manafort side would say, are national security risks.
There was one more revelation this week about Paul Manafort, which is that a week or two before the election, he offered to a well-known Russian gang figure who is very closely tied to Putin to give him briefings on the election. So the links between Manafort
and
Russians.
I don't know if it's
Russians,
it's a billionaire. I think calling him a gang leader is, might be a little heavy.
All right. An oligarch, we
An
can
oligarch
say that.
For sure. Yes.
That smells, but it's not illegal.
Yeah. No, it's not illegal, but it suggests a relationship with Russians close to Putin and tied to the election itself. That raises lots of questions.
And you know what's really interesting? It looks like there are now increasing tensions between Trump's lawyers and defenders and Manafort's lawyers and defenders, which could mean a potential problem here, because Manafort, in the end, will want to protect himself, and he may provide information on the campaign. That's one of the big questions. Is there information for him to provide, and will he provide it?
I think this is the problem for Paul Manafort. I lived in Russia for 2 years, and Russians operate by completely different rules, obviously, than Americans do. Paul Manafort, I think, was successful because he learned to operate by Russians' rules. Now, did those rules mean he did things that are illegal in this country? That's the question that we have to get an answer for.
And we shouldn't discount something else that was very important that happened just over a week ago, which is the news that the Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, is now working together with Robert Mueller and his team. You can pardon an individual for federal offenses, but not state ones. And many of the issues around Manafort surround money laundering or other kinds of crimes that can be brought as a state crime. And so the idea, of course, what happens in these investigations is you move up the chain. You try and get people to tell more about those above them with the threat that you'll be going to jail. Right. If you can't be pardoned, and you could be going to jail for 20 or 30 years, you have much more incentive to talk about the higher-ups.
Okay, we'll have more on the Friday News Roundup with Norm Ornstein, EJ Dionne, and Lisa Desjardins just ahead. Please stay close. I'm John Donvan, host of Intelligence Squared U.S., sitting in for Joshua Johnson for the Friday News Roundup on 1A with PBS NewsHour correspondent Lisa Desjardins, AEI resident scholar Norm Ornstein, and E.J. Dion of the Brookings Institution. And Norm and E.J. are also co-authors of a new book with Thomas Mann called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. And speaking of Donald Trump, right away, we've been talking about bouncing off the fact that he gave his first address to the UN General Assembly Tuesday, a truly national, international audience. But he laid down a heavy pro-nationalist argument, and some of it went like this.
From its very first moments, the American story is the story of what is possible when people take ownership of their future. The United States of America has been among the greatest forces for good in the history of the world and the greatest defenders of sovereignty, security, and prosperity for all. Now we are calling for a great reawakening of nations, for the revival of their spirits, their pride, their people, and their patriotism.
I found it interesting that he was telling the story of America. I sensed in what he intended to be a positive way. He wanted to say, it was
Absolutely.
A little bit be like us, but not completely. It was do the right thing. Lisa, did you hear it that way? And do you think
Absolutely.
It was taken that way by
Yeah,
the world?
He said America doesn't want to, force anything on the world, but that it wants to shine its example upon the world.
Yeah.
It was definitely sort of an American excellence kind of speech. I think what this president is saying—
But was it friendly or was it hubristic?
Well, that's debatable, I think. I think there's disagreement over that. I think that this president believes it was friendly, that he has a vision for the world in which self-interest is not only okay, but is right and leads to peace. The two words that I think he said the most in that speech were sovereign 21 times and peace 15 mm-hmm. times. Mm-hmm. That's his vision. But for most everyone else, they don't understand the logic of that, because if each nation is only about its self-interest, that leads to conflict.
Well, we have a book to talk about, and it's been co-authored by two of our guests today, as well as one who's not here, that's Thomas Mann, but our guests, again, Norm Ornstein and E.J. Dion, came out with a book that I guess you've been working on in a hurry, One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. So it sounds a little bit like it's a day after kind of book, I'm guessing. E.J., what is this after? The after effect that I think that you're writing about.
Well, what we try to do in the book, it is a book we had to write fast, obviously, but we also tried to be serious about what happened, how do we get to Trump, what threat does he pose, and what should we do about it? We have an analysis of the election where we talk about the influence of both race, culture, immigration, but also the economic context in which the election happened. And the fact, by the way, that we are increasingly a non-majoritarian democracy. Trump lost the popular vote. The Senate is not representative of the country as a whole. Gerrymandering distorts the House. And then we talk about the threat he poses. But in the back half of the book, we really felt it was important that we weren't just arguing that there is a problem with Trump. We want to solve the problems that both created the Trump possibility and that Trump has deepened since he was in power. So we talk a lot about reforms of the economy so that we don't have these wide gaps between regions in our country, some very affluent, some not. Political reforms that actually do drain the swamp as opposed to pretending to drain the swamp. And also strengthening civil society, those institutions that hold us together that have really been hammered along with individuals because of the economic inequality. And finally, we call for a new patriotism rooted in empathy. We need a country where citizens can really start trying to understand each other's struggles. And if you hold one group's pain against another group's pain and divide us that way, we are not going to make progress as a nation.
And Norm, are you arguing that this transformation can only happen after Trump is out of office?
No, it started, and we need to start it now. And the parse this out, John. It's one nation. And that is, as E.J. said, it's getting back to e pluribus unum, out of many one, that we have been fractured for some time, fractured in political terms as partisanship turned to tribalism, fractured in racial terms, fractured in regional terms, and now even within regions and states between the metropolitan areas that are economic engines and the rural and exurban areas that are declining. But Trump at some point will be gone. But we have to begin to look at where our nation will be going, and it is something, an exercise that started now. And I do think, getting back to the United Nations, what we're seeing is, beyond all of these challenges that the society faced that led up to and allowed a Trump to emerge, a president unlike any that we have seen before, there are challenges now to some of the fundamentals that we have lived under in the post-World War II era. Trump's speech may not have been entirely hostile, as Lisa said, but it is a vision of a world that's dramatically different than one where there's a NATO, where there are alliances, where you join together to promote values. And if you think about the context now, in Myanmar, we have genocide going on against a group of Muslims. In Turkey, we've got a tightening noose around an autocracy that is arresting journalists and anybody who might be seen as an opponent. We know what's happening in Russia and many of these other countries. And in effect, what Trump was saying is, go ahead. You have sovereignty. We have sovereignty. So challenges now with Trump and whether we're going to be able to promote a world that's like the one we've seen before, and many of the challenges domestically, including those put forward by the Congress, that we know he'll sign almost anything that they put in front of him. But we also have to start to heal those fractures that are much deeper than Trump itself.
Could I just say one other thing? There was a line in a review of our book. I think the phrase the reviewer used was imaginative hope. And I really like that because we look at the Trump period and we see some great potential threats here, including autocratic tendencies in Trump. When you trash judges, trash the media, and demonize your opponents, those are the classic behaviors of would-be autocrats. But we also see and underscore in this book the fact that the response to Trump has been extraordinary. You have people who are getting engaged in politics now who were not engaged before. You have civil society organizations that have thrown themselves into the defense of immigrants and deportees and programs for the needy. You have young people saying, I might run for city council now because I want to change the country. And so I think that great crises can create great opportunities. And as my friend Norm likes to say, Trump gave the system a big jolt. And that jolt is awakening us to problems that we had before that we now know we have to deal with.
Norm, your analysis has been for a while that most of the problem, that the Republicans are more at fault, have more responsibility for creating the situation that we're in now. And an analysis which, of course, opens you to charges, I'm sure, of being partisan. And I'm sure your position is no, you're being analytical. But take that thought forward to the future. If the Republican establishment or conglomerate of interest groups is somewhat to blame for getting us into this situation that you decry, do they also have a part to play, a positive role to play in getting us out of it?
They certainly do. And one of the things we have to emphasize here is our political system depends on having two problem-solving parties. They're going to have different worldviews, but they need to be problem-solving. And problem-solving in our political system also means working across lines and finding broad leadership consensus. One of the heartening things here, E.J. mentioned all these other groups, is the number of Republican and conservative policy intellectuals, sadly not including many now in government, who are stepping up and saying just that and trying to reclaim the Republican Party. It'll be a conservative party. The Jennifer Rubins and Max Boots and Evan McMullins and Michael Gersons and Bill Kristol's of the world. So we want a Republican Party that's vibrant and competitive, but it's got to be a different party than the one we talked about at the beginning that is pushing policies that just don't make a lot of sense for the reason of just trying to win.
And what about the Democratic Party, EJ?
Well, we argue that what's important for the Democrats is to realize that their job is to bring together groups whom Donald Trump is trying to divide one from the other. I have been struck, somebody posted the picture of it, and it reminded me that the 1963 Great Civil Rights March, the slogan was jobs and freedom. And that what Trump wants us to think is you're either for white working class people or you are for African-Americans and Latinos. Well, first of all, a lot of African-Americans and Latinos are in the working class. And secondly, there are problems these groups have that are particular to them, and there's a history of racism that we have to acknowledge as a country. But there are problems they have in common from deindustrialization, economic change. And I think it's the job of the Democrats, and great Democrats like FDR and Robert Kennedy have done this in the past, to speak to these groups and say, let us get together to make this country more just, more fair, and create opportunity for everyone. That's what Democrats do at their best. That's what they got to do now.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to 1A.
First of all, I'm geeking out sitting between these two guys. I can hardly speak because this is a fantastic conversation. And I think it strikes me that covering Congress every day and covering the White House occasionally when John Yang isn't around is that this is a completely different conversation than what's happening in Congress right now. And that's the problem. And I think that one of the main reasons in talking to members of Congress who I think are more honest with me is money, you know, and that the amount of money that's in politics right now and the way districts have been carved out, which I think is a result, perhaps, of the money. And you can go back to Newt Gingrich, obviously, in 1994. But that the incentives are all moving the wrong way, and they're moving away from actual working together to craft good policy, which is what these two are talking about.
We have some tweets and emails coming in reflecting on the conversations we've had for most of the past hour. We have a tweet from Hedwig who says, thank you for sharing the conditions of the U.S. Virgin Islands. We have remained invisible in many reports about Maria and Irma. Tony Irvine tweets, true self-interest will avoid the war despite the supercilious sneering by the panelists. That would be the three of you. This has been an accepted philosophy. And then we have a potential fact check emailed from David. He says, one of your guests misstated the latest info about Paul Manafort. Manafort promised private briefings to the Russian oligarch shortly before Trump was nominated as the GOP candidate for president, not, as the guest said, shortly before the election. I think that's accurate.
That is accurate. That's what I meant to say.
The fact check is accurate.
Right. It was during the campaign. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's the point.
Great if I misstated it,
absolutely,
that they corrected it.
Yeah,
could
right.
I comment? Was it sneering? What was the
supercilious
sneering?
I like that.
Yes.
That's Pat Buchanan speech writing at its best.
That's right.
I just want to make a point back to him, which is, let's think about self-interest. Let's think about how individuals behave in the world. Do we succeed if we act only in a selfish way? No. We succeed, individuals succeed, when they can also act in common with their friends, their neighbors, their fellow citizens to get things done. And the problem with America First is that it's not really in America's interests. It's in America's interest to stand for things larger than just our own self-interest, because that's how we get allies to help us.
But quickly, I think the point this person might be making is that that's a debate. You know, that's a very well-articulated view in that debate. But there are many, going back to Ayn Rand, who believe that self-interest is the way. And that's a much larger philosophical debate. But that is where our president is coming from, is a different side of that debate.
Correct. And America First didn't really work great before World War II. And I think there are problems with it still.
To finish up the hour, I just want to have a little bit of a check-in on an individual who has emerged back in the public eye after a little bit of a disappearance. Sean Spicer, the former press secretary for President Trump, made a surprise appearance on the Emmy Awards and came out standing behind something that looked like his old podium, and he said this.
This will be the largest audience to witness an Emmys, period.
And that was controversial for basically for the reason that I think out in Hollywood there was a sense that he was being Hollywood not friendly as a rule to Sean Spicer and the political point of view he stood for, making the point that it was too soon to rehabilitate him. We actually hear he's having a little bit of a difficult time landing a new gig. NBC News is saying that he's having a hard time finding a pundit job or a spokesperson job. But what did you take on, is it time to give Sean Spicer a break?
Oh, I don't know. You know what this all reminded me of? First of all, Sean Spicer went to my Benedictine High School.
Hey.
So I'm still mad at Donald Trump for excluding him from the visit
Vatican.
To Pope Francis. I think that sent Sean a message about the kind of guy he chose to work for. What I was thinking of, James Carville once said that once you become a celebrity, that's what you do for a living. And that is what Sean Spicer is now doing for a living. But there, you know, there is something strange about how easy you can pass from one realm to another without any stop signs, any interruption, or any real debate about does it really make sense to go from here to there. Right. Norm?
You know, this is a broader conversation we're having now because Harvard University has brought in Corey Lewandowski and Spicer as fellows, was going to bring in Chelsea Manning. And it's partly the cult of celebrity. It's also a question of how you handle people who have strayed very substantially from our larger consensus or the norms that we have. And Spicer strayed very significantly.
And unfortunately, right from the start at that first news conference.
Although he said this week that he never knowingly told told a mistruth.
Well, there's another one. But remember, this is also somebody who worked with people outside to attack Seth Rich and the family that has gone through horrors after their son was murdered on the streets of Washington. There are some bad things here that happened, and it's rehabilitation perhaps, but the cult of celebrity, as E.J. said, seems to have dominated.
And then there are the Spicer notebooks.
That's right.
Apparently the Mueller investigation wants to get a look at what Sean Spicer wrote down because it was a lot. But we just scratched the surface this week on some of the...
Just super briefly, I want to say this is a media danger zone. When we get into a self-righteous area about a character rather than policy, it's a trap.
True enough.
Your speaking just now makes my goodbye to you much shorter than it was going to be. So I want to thank Lisa Desjardins, Norm Ornstein, and E.J. Dionne. Once again, I do have time to mention their book, One Nation After Trump. There's an excerpt of that on our website, the1a.org. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you. This program
comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm John Donvan in for Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.